listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 29th edition of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR. And again, Luciana, we're promising them that we're going to wrap up this segment that deals with the question of Leninism versus Trotskyism, or really of the role that both each Lenin and Trotsky played in the revolution and then after Lenin's death in Soviet history. I think yeah. where we left it at a point where I had kind of summarized last week that at each place, whether it's in 1903, 1905, 1912, 1917, and beyond, where the circumstances presented a choice for the first the composition of the party and then the tasks of that party once it was composed, Lenin and the people around Lenin made choices that turned out to be correct, and Trotsky was in opposition to them in each and every case. Sometimes holding himself out as more of a socialist or a revolutionary or a leftist, what Lenin would call ultra-left, and in other cases clearly right, and this is going down even into the 40s when he starts to collaborate with Huac. So maybe we can sort of parse this out a little more fully, and then we can put it to rest.
Very good. So, yes, you are quite. You did quite a good comprehensive introduction. So we are looking at the events of the year 1917 leading to the Bolshevik Revolution of October. And indeed, we are looking at Trotsky's role in this revolution. Now, we said that his role in action is not in dispute. It is acknowledged that he fought well, but he was not the leader of this revolution. He was accepted into the Bolshevik Party, as we mentioned, in late July 17. He was voted head of the Petrograd Soviet, but he had come in too late to have been part of the discussion, the debates, the planning, the voting and decision of the Central Committee of the Bolshevik Party to actually earn the credit of having been the mastermind of the revolution. This had been Lenin. And so we ask, why is it important to examine Trotsky's role? Isn't that in the past? Shouldn't we just move on and forget about this guy? We can't. Because his opposition to the character of the Bolshevik Party, as we know, as you mentioned from the beginning, had been consistent from 1903 to 1917 and after. And the Bolshevik Party was the party of the revolution. So because his opposition character of the Bolshevik Party, and this character was select, you know, it was decided that the Bolshevik Party would be run by informed people, not a club, not open right. to everybody. And also because his characterization of Stalin's government as a betrayal of the revolution,
right.
in my view, and I'm sure helped the Western left in particular, to disown the Soviet Union as a deformed worker state. Right. Now, this requires just a bit of clarification. By Western left, I mean all those parties after 1945 that formed in Europe as communist parties, and which in 1956, when Khrushchev made his secret speech denouncing Stalin and demonizing him, the Western left had a vacuum, was faced with this terrifying notion that the Soviet Union had been a terrible mistake, had betrayed the revolution. They had nothing left.
You know what's interesting. Interesting about that is an interesting set. This is actually a set of nested contradictions. The one that is necessary, first of all, contextual thing that's necessary is that these left parties and communist parties, quote unquote, that were established in the post World War II Western Europe were done under a condition of American occupation. The United States occupied Western, I would
Italy.
Say, occupies Western Europe. And so, Italy, Germany, France, the Benelux countries.
Holland,
you know, all
Belgium,
of this. All of it. And then in the other countries that ultimately, many of which ultimately became part of the Warsaw Pact. I mean, these are countries that were the subject of Yalta and Potsdam and all of that, you know, for what was going to happen in the post-war environment. The U.S. was very well represented there also, as were the bourgeois leadership and industrialists of the pre-war period, many of whom were actually Nazi collaborators, Hitler was rising. So, you know, the pedigree of the so-called leftists and communists is not only suspect, it's clear that collaboration with Western capital was, you know, exactly their purpose and their job. That's one thing. The other is, on the question of Trotskyism generally and its critique, the ultimate critique that the Soviet Union was a distorted worker state, and the distortion being an accusation of bureaucratism and insularity. In other words, it's a small club that runs everything. Is sort of the mature version of the embryonic critique back in 1903 to 1905 when Lenin says the party should consist of people, it should be a small group of dedicated revolutionaries who are highly educated in the history of society and economics and revolution and government and all of the things that are necessary to actually conduct a successful revolution. And on the other hand, Trotsky saying, we should let everybody in. And we should make, further down the road, he says, and we should make common cause with the bourgeoisie because that's the next step in development. So in other words, these professional revolutionaries that Trotsky rails against in 1903 end up being the bureaucratic state that he rails against in the 1920s and 30s.
Precisely.
And he doesn't posit an alternative for how to successfully establish socialism because, you know what, it hasn't happened anywhere else by another model. Perhaps they were on the way in Chile for about 10 minutes in the early 70s, but not many examples elsewhere.
Well, well, the question is, where did the Trotsky revolution succeed?
Nowhere.
I mean, I can't think of a single example. Go ahead.
I was just going to remind people of the discussion we had about what happened in Barcelona, for example, where this technique actually ended up undermining the Spanish Civil War in favor of fascism.
Lenin called it adventurism, that is, jumping in and not considering what the forces are with whom you could actually ally to get the support for the proletarian, which in certain, especially in Spain, was not, other than in Catalonia, was not big. But yes, Spain is a good example of the complete destructive influence on the fight against fascism, which was threatening the republic.
Right.
You know, I mean, you have fascism at the gate, and you're going to build out of that opportunism, out of that opportunity, you're going to jump from well-armed fascism into a proletarian revolution.
Yeah, I mean, what ended up happening was the Spanish fascism ended up being the most thoroughly established fascism in Europe.
Yep, and the most long-lasting.
Right.
Yeah. So, it is consequential to talk about Trotsky not as something that happened in the past, but it's something that had that affected the left when, particularly in the 50s, as you say, yes, Europe was occupied and it ordered the Communist Party to disarm. It didn't order the Communist Party to disarm. It ordered the government they put in place to disarm. That was, you know, not to continue the resistance into the revolution. The occupation did that. The United States preferred a return of the monarchy in Italy. It occupation attempted to put the French Communist Party out of law, illegal, same in Italy, except that people, even the governor, the government established by the Allies said, look, we can't make the Communist Party illegal because we would have a civil war. They're the ones that are trained, armed. That's why taking away the arms was important. So the occupation has had its role, okay? It's really effective role in terms of having the, reestablishing the fascist police in Italy, et cetera, all the instruments of oppression of the people's struggles. But ideologically, what happened in 1956 was this horrendous revelation, apparently horrendous. I mean, horrendous it was, this that the whole period from 1917, or at least conveniently from Lenin's death in 1924 to 1956, the Soviet Union was a horrendous counter-revolution, and that it was not communist, that it created mass killings, that it was horror. And then Khrushchev supported that. And then where did the parties go? They couldn't be associated with Moscow anymore, though, you know, the Italian Communist Party continued until the 70s to be aligned with Moscow. But then in the 70s, the Berlinguer leadership of the Italian Communist Party recognized NATO, which is a big deal, in order to make an alliance with the Social Democrats, with the Christian Democrats, to share in power. So, right. So the demonization of the Soviet Union created the conditions in which we are now, which we have no parties of the proletariat anywhere, but in a few places on the earth, which happen to be very populated, and I think it's China. A Communist Party is in Vietnam, in Laos, and in Cuba. And
DPRK.
Excuse me a sec.
Yeah, and DPRK as well.
But you see what I'm saying is that this double demonization, one of the Bolshevik Party as an organizing structure of the state and of its policies, the demonization of this party, and the demonization within the person of Stalin had a tremendous negative, destructive effect on the progress of the left in Europe.
Yep. And in the United States, too.
And in the United States.
And ultimately...
In the Anglo, actually Australian, you know, in the Anglo countries, in particular. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's right. And that ended up coming back home. Those were chickens that came home to roost in the Soviet Union. In the person of Mikhail Gorbachev and that entire trend, which then was a gift that kept on giving. You had what happened in the USSR, which ultimately, you know, ended in the dissolution of the USSR and the surrender of most of the nation states to Western capital. And then the dissolution almost simultaneously, this was in December of 1991 in the United States, of the Communist Party of the USA, with the Committees of Correspondence. This was a group named after the group in the first American Revolution in like 1773, where they were organizing the colonies against Britain. Inside the Communist Party, there was a group called the Committees of Correspondence, and they essentially proposed, Angela Davis, Pete Seeger, and Gil Green proposed in December of 91 that the party abandon Lenin. And go multi-party, in other words, become like a Euro-communist party or whatever. And, you know, that's what's left of the left in the U.S., and it follows a direct lineage from Trotsky in 1903 through the things you were just describing.
Yes, that's right. If you abandon Lenin in times of such as now intense imperialism, you are promoting imperialism. You're letting it go on. So if you're on the left and you abandon Lenin, you abandon his theory of imperialism or his critique of imperialism. And you can't be a Marxist. You can't be on the left and not be a Marxist-Leninist in these times.
Well,
yeah.
That's right.
So, it was Lenin who developed the theory of imperialism, who identified its features, why it must go that way, why capitalism must be imperialism, how financial capital takes over and monopoly, and how it inevitably leads to war.
Right.
Inevitably, you know, I mean,
Well, it makes the class, it gives the class war an international and a nation-state context. You have, you know, an elite that governs the colonial powers. In essence, now that's been distilled down to the elite that governs the U.S., EU, UK, Japan, South Korea, Australia, a couple of other little spots. That those capitalists dominate the nation states, the military of the United States, and of the of NATO, and of whatever's left of CETO or whatever they call it this weekend. And they direct that to extracting value from both internally and the rest of the world. And in terms of extracting value from the rest of the world, there are governments that are either not completely at the beck and call of Western capital, or that are themselves hostile to it and assert their own sovereignty, and thereby lies the condition for war. You have nation states that are competing over the resources, most of them competing for control of their own resources against Western capital.
Yeah, exactly. So to examine, you know, Trotsky's role is not to talk about the past. And, it's anti-communism, and it is affecting us all in terms of fighting imperialism. So anyway, so it is important to examine Trotsky's role because, as we said, his opposition to the character of the Bolshevik Party from the beginning was consistent. He tried to undermine it. Because his characterization of Stalin's government as a betrayal of the revolution helped the Western left, as we said, in particular, to disown the Soviet Union. You dissolve the Soviet Union, you dissolve the attempt at communism, to disown the Soviet Union as a deformed worker state. So in both his attacks on the party as an oppressive caste of bureaucrats, and his demonization of Stalin as not Lenin's faithful lieutenant, you know, they happen to coincide and sustain the anti-communist Western legends of the Soviet Union that is dominant narrative of Western propaganda to this day. Now, Trotsky, I will say that you know, we have Trotsky, we have Khrushchev. Why the hell did he change the name of Stalingrad to Volgograd? And do we think, is there a connection between Trotsky, who was more on the left than, let's say, the right wing of the Bolshevik Party, which was the Bukharinite branch?
Right.
And so Khrushchev actually came out of that kind of branch. We're talking about Trotsky as a counter-revolutionary, really. And no matter what he thought in his head, he was. In fact, you could say that it was not Stalin that betrayed the revolution, but betrayed the revolution as it was conducted by Lenin. But Trotsky, if he ever had any real commitment to that revolution, the one that succeeded. It is significant that Trotsky joined the Bolsheviks at the moment when their victory was a great possibility.
Right.
So the Bolshevik Party until Khrushchev actually remained a solid bedrock of the socialist state. It was the organ that implemented socialism in the Soviet Union, as we have amply detailed earlier, and it was Stalin's government that made sure that socialism advanced and defended itself from fascism and defeated it. So Trotsky, by attacking the party and its leadership, acted as a counter-revolutionary.
Yep.
Until Lenin died, Trotsky held his opposition in check. But in 1924, he practically offered, and I think this is crucial, Trotskyism as an alternative ideology, though he called it the continuation of Leninism. Trotskyism, and we haven't identified its features yet, and I don't know if we'll succeed today, as an alternative ideology. I mean, the features were permanent revolution and a condemnation of socialism in one country. Those were the biggest two aspects of it. So he offered Trotskyism as an alternative ideology, though he called it Leninism. He called himself a Leninist. So in 1924, after Lenin died, and Trotsky mounted this Trotskyism campaign that is the true heir to Lenin, it was 1924 that Stalin asked, if Trotskyism is Leninism, why do we need this new word, Trotskyism?
Right.
And it was in 1924 that Stalin had to take on Trotskyism before the committee, the Politburo, etc., to expose its ideological flaws. Now, the first charge in this Trotskyism movement formation, let's call it, was that Trotsky played a special role in the October uprising. Now, we have, in the last recording, in the last conversation, we exposed that, we analyzed that, and I don't want to go over all that again, but and we mentioned that he joined the party late. He didn't know what was going on. I mean, he hadn't been part of the decisions, and he was made the chief of the Petrograd Soviet and followed whatever the decisions had been made by the committee. So he followed orders.
Right.
Now, the other thing we haven't discussed is the charge by Trotskyism that the Bolshevik Party had been ineffective. And Stalin says that listening to Trotsky, you would think that during the whole period of preparation from March to October, the Bolshevik Party did nothing but mark time, that it was being corroded by internal contradictions, and that it hindered Lenin in every way. That had it not been for Trotsky, nobody knows how the October Revolution would have ended. This is, okay, so...
It's just not true. It's just not true. I mean, there's zero
right.
evidence of it, and an awful lot of evidence to the contrary. A huge record of it, yeah.
Exactly. And Stalin explains very carefully what actually happened between February and October, and explains the major facts of this period, and why the Bolshevik Party could not act in between February and April and different phases of the year. So he says that between March and April, what you had was a kind of parallel government. Both you had in power or ruling both the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, which was the Cadet Kerensky, the bourgeois revolution of February. You had it coexisting with what had been formed in this period, the group, the dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry. It wasn't, you had the proletariat and the peasantry and the bourgeois revolution and the bourgeoisie running the country, or at the head of the country. The proletariat and the peasantry trusted the bourgeois revolution. They believed that it was striving for peace. They voluntarily surrendered their power to the bourgeoisie. And so they became an appendage, these Soviets of the bourgeoisie, these type of Soviets, these ones that formed in February, became a mere appendage of the bourgeoisie. And there was yet no serious conflict between the two. So meantime, in the Bolshevik Party, the idea, the pre-revolutionary platform of the direct overthrow of the government was clear and definite, but it was no longer possible to go straight for the overthrow of the government because the government was connected with the Soviets.
Right.
And the biggest influence within the Soviet Party was for the defense of the country, that is, for the war. They were called the defensists. So the party, if it took on at that point the February Revolution, the
Kerensky
government.
Right.
The party had to wage war against both the government, the bourgeoisie, and the Soviets. That revolution would not have happened.
Right.
It was beyond their strength. They had the proletarians and the peasantry and the bourgeoisie.
Right. That's right.
To fight.
And it also wouldn't have been representative of the society, by the way, had they not looked to the Soviets for basically as one of the legs of power. All right, we have to stop there. I want to get next week, I don't know, maybe it'll take us a week or two to get there, but one really important question with respect to Trotsky is how Trotsky viewed imperialism, what imperialism was. And it's really extremely relevant to the situation today. Essentially, Trotsky, his perspective on this, as detailed by Stalin in 1932, for example, resembles almost identically the idea of globalism here, that the sweeping away of national boundaries, even if it's done by imperialism, is a step forward. And Lenin had an entirely different view, and that's, I think, where we'll pick it up next week. Luciana, thank you very much. We'll see you, talk with you next week.
My pleasure, as always. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. After marathon coalition negotiations, Germany's ruling parties have agreed on a compromise that may yet be scuppered by Social Democrats' rank-and-file constituents. Is this tug of war in forming a new government a sign of regular birthing pangs or of something extraordinary happening in German politics? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Kurt Biddenkopf, a veteran German politician and former Prime Minister of Saxony. Mr. Biddenkopf, it's an honor talking to you. Thank you very much for your time. The makeup of the future German government is still very much up in the air, even though a provisional deal has been agreed upon. I wonder, what does your intuition tell you? Do you think the SPD voters are likely to endorse this deal?
Well, finally, the voters, and especially the voters on the part of the Social Democratic Party, decided to ask all the members whether they agree to the negotiated cooperations between the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats. I think that it will work. People are finally waiting rather restlessly. It said that the government should be formed as fast as possible. Mm-hmm.
Now, if this deal stands, Germany will get the same old political arrangement, the same grand coalition that governed Germany since 2013, even though the very difficulty of forming this government stems from the fact that German politics has changed and the election results do demonstrate that. Do you think it's a good idea in principle to have the same old political arrangement when the politics has changed so much?
No, it's not. It's not a good idea. it came along because it seemed very difficult to form a government because we didn't have a two-party system. It would very easily worked one way or the other, but we have an open system where everybody who has more than 5% of the electorate on its side will be a member of or will be represented in the parliament. Now, we had small parties, we had larger parties, but one of the facts is that the CDU and CSU, or I'll talk about the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, had lost in the last election, and that was really a trend. The two parties, for instance, in the 70s or 80s, were the major party and one additional party, the Free Democrats. Now we have a mixture of parties. And to form a government, if neither of the parties has a dominated, is dominating in size, you have to have two or three parties work together. And that's difficult.
And why is that so difficult for the Christian Democrats, which still remain one of the dominant parties, to enlist the support of the smaller players?
Well, the Social Democrats were very uncertain as to whether to continue the combination with the Christian Democrats, even though the Christian Democrats did not have a majority or needed two other parties, at least for a majority, were inviting the Social Democrats to participate. But in this participation during the last couple of legislative periods, the Social Democrats lost in influence and power, and that's one of the reasons they didn't want to rejoin with the Christian Democrats.
I got it from your articles that there is a lot of disagreement in Germany about the extent of the social burden that the state has to take upon itself. And for example, you had a very interesting idea that one of the reasons why the support for the AfD was so strong, the alternative for Germany, was the kind of resentment towards the state assuming more social obligations, including towards the migrants.
The migrant question and the immigration question. The immigration question and the refugee question have raised considerable resistance in the population because there's a very uncertain condition as to how to integrate this influx of a great number of people. Emanating or coming from areas in this world which have a very different way of life, different attitudes, different religions, etc., etc., and are not necessarily or are not at all from European origin. So the population will have to adapt to a different composition of the population. And that makes it very difficult to allow a great number of people in a very short period of time to enter Germany. This is one of the basic issues issues that the AfD, as you mentioned it, it has been built into a party and has taken an issue with.
Now, one thing that upset and frightened many about the latest German elections was the success of the Alternative for Germany, or the AfD, which entered parliament for the first time. And people who dislike the AfD usually refer to it as xenophobic or even fascist. But you make an interesting point in one of your articles that one of the factors driving the support for the AfD was the sense of resentment about the expanding social obligations, including towards many thousands of migrants. Do you think the critics and the detractors of the AfD appreciate this social grievance enough?
No, there are very different issues. One of the issues is that Germany has an elder population. In other words, the younger generation is much smaller than, for instance, the younger generation when I had my family and my children. So there is an aging German population. And the aging German population will need young people from abroad, from other countries, if it wants to maintain its present industrial and economic strength. So there would be a great reason or an important reason to have foreign young people into Germany. On the other hand, the older population has great difficulty to adapt to a substantial change of the composition of the German population. So we have different levels of interest or influx of difficult adjustments.
Now, I heard you say in one of your interviews that one of Chancellor Merkel's motivations in letting migrants in such large numbers was precisely to address Germany's long-term demographic problem. Just as you said, the shortage in the labor force, as well as the increase in the elderly population. But and that may seem like a viable policy option, but do you think the German people were even asked whether they want to pursue that route? And did they have to be asked whether they want to follow that policy option?
Well, they're being asked in the context of elections. And since we have elections both on the state and the nation level, as on the state level of 16 states, and they are not all at the same time, we have a very, very interesting and operative way to find out what the population think. But the real problem that we have is that the refugees were not coming into Germany to add to the smaller German younger population. They were fleeing from wars. And the issue was a moral one, not an economic one, when Angela Merkel decided to open the door, so to speak. And of course, we had an influx, a tremendous influx, in a short period of time until we succeeded in sort of get order into that process. The most young people who tried to come to Europe and Germany really had reason to flee their own countries. In the process, more and more young people did not come because they had to flee, but because they wanted to come to Europe and to Germany, and especially to enjoy the opportunities that have risen in Germany for a long period of time. We had one of these processes in the 60s and early 70s, mainly the 60s, when about 2 to 3 million immigrants, if you want to call it that way, from Turkey, from Italy and Spain, but then from Turkey, came into Germany because we needed them. This time, it is not an invitation to young people to come to Germany, but there was a resistance, and there is a resistance within the population to have further immigration to Germany because people are worried, and this is one of the issues that the AfD is playing on, that the national character of Germany might be changed to some way.
But Mr. Birrenkopf, I would agree with you that the AfD is perhaps exploiting this issue too much, but don't you think that part of the reason why they have been allowed to exploit it is also that the government hasn't had a full discussion, an open discussion of this extremely touchy subject, because it's not just a moral issue as Chancellor Merkel likes to present it. It's also a social issue. It's an issue about how your country is going to look like for decades and decades. And when I say look like, I don't mean the ethnic aspect of it, but it's a serious decision and it's a serious policy change. Don't you think that that issue perhaps should have been discussed a little bit more with the society so that people wouldn't feel that those migrants are being forced on them?
Ever since the first measure of Angela Merkel, we are discussing it. It's not that the people are not angst. That's maybe an impression in Moscow. But there's a very broad debate which has now subsided because an increasing part of the population is understanding that there is an economic and a social problem, and social questions usually have a moral content. So you cannot separate social and moral, basic moral issues.
Well, Mr. Birrenkopf, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Kurt Birrenkopf, a veteran German politician and former prime minister of Saxony. Mr. Birrenkopf, just before the break, we were talking about leadership, and Angela Merkel has been in power for quite a long time, almost as long as Vladimir Putin. Now, one of the benefits of staying in power for so long is obviously the experience. But on the other hand, there are multiple studies suggesting that when people stay in power for that long, their perception of reality changes in many important ways. You've been a political animal for most of your life. How long is too long for a head of state?
Angela Merkel has now had three terms. If I would have asked her, if she would have asked me, I would say be very careful with trying to get a fourth one. The same problem arose with Helmut Kohl, and the fourth term he had was only really accepted because he had two different blocks of terms, chancellor in a divided Germany and chancellor in a united Germany. But if I were able to reform our constitution on that issue, I would look very much to countries that have limited the election of an individual to the top government position, like in the United States, where just one re-election is possible. You can also have two re-elections, but if you have a limitation, then the government is almost forced by the situation to think about the continuation through electing other people in the next term. You have more mobility.
Now, Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin may have very different personalities, but their political trajectories do have certain overlaps. Both have been in power for quite some time, and both now deal with the countries undergoing profound changes. In Germany, it's the reintegration of migrants. In Russia, it's economic and hopefully political reforms. Do you think established leaders like that can change with the times? In politics, can you teach an old dog new tricks?
No. They don't change. A political leader that has been in office a very long time usually feels that he has done everything well so he could continue. And he's not very receptive to the idea that not the leader, but the general condition has should change in response to the change in society.
You know that ties between Russia and Germany have a very long and perhaps a very complicated history. And they certainly took a big hit in 2014 after the events in Crimea and more broadly in Ukraine. Do you think we will still see any improvement between our countries while Angela Merkel or Vladimir Putin, for that matter, are in office? Or will we have to wait for somebody to replace them?
Well, to a certain extent, both countries are interested and should be interested in relations that to have two or three objectives. The most objective is to maintain peace, regardless of what conflicts may arise. The second issue is economic exchange and technological exchange, but especially trade. Trading between, and there is a lot of trade. Third, there is should be an offer to understand the differences that have always governed the relationship between Russia and Germany. We have different histories way back. We have different philosophies. We have different attitudes towards government, and we have differences to. In the extent of participation of the population in government issues. So we should learn why this is so, and we should understand.
Now, you mentioned the issue of trade, and I know that you come from East Germany. Just last month, we had leaders from five lands in East Germany coming out with a statement saying that they oppose sanctions against Russia because they view them as both inefficient and unfair. Their point was that East Germany is paying a much higher price for those sanctions than West Germany. Do you think they have a point, and do you think their voices are heard in Berlin?
Well, I don't think you should put too much emphasis on these statements. We do have certain sanctions, and we have considered them well. And it is very difficult, and of course, vice versa, Russia would also try to influence the behavior of Germany in, let's say, restraint in trade and other forms of communication. I'm not a very great friend of sanctions, but there are always some issues that one or the other country is trying by way of sanctions to change the attitude of the other partner. And I don't think they can do away with that. As to the size of East Germany, or the East German states, in terms of population, all of them, the five of them, have as much population, the same size of Bavaria. So the five are important, but they certainly do not form Germany, even more so, European activities in the trade field.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that sanctions, one of the purposes of sanctions is to change the behavior. And most of the German sanctions originate in Russia's perceived behavior in Crimea. Angela Merkel believes that borders should not be changed. And perhaps, I think on some level, even Vladimir Putin will agree with her on that. But I'm sure you understand that for Russia, in Crimea, it was not only a matter of principle, it was a matter of strategic security, the expansion of NATO, the possibility of losing the base in the Black Sea. And those, when you deal with strategic security, it's very difficult to uphold principles, even if you agree with that. Do you think Russia could have played any other way, or alternatively, do you think that Russia is likely to repeat what has happened in Crimea?
Well, this is a very difficult question that I would have to think about, because it reaches far beyond the issue of sanctions that we have just discussed. Sanctions could be justified. I'm just with this reservation in relationship to the developments in Ukraine or in other border states, and there's in the feeling of Europe, not Germany alone, of Europe, the development in Ukraine is considered to be unfortunate. And now the only way to put this to Russia is not by just simply arguing, but also by introducing cooperations or solutions of conflict in this field. So far, we haven't been very successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, you know that the Crimean issue, at least for Russia, is closely linked to NATO, its eastward expansion, which traces its roots back to German reunification and the promises that were made to Moscow back then and that were not necessarily followed
through. Wait a minute,
what
kind of promises have made that were not carried through?
Well, it is believed, at least this is an opinion in Moscow, that Russia was promised that NATO will not expand to the east following the reunification of Germany.
Hold a minute. It has not expanded towards east unless countries in the east ask to be permitted to join. But the NATO as such has not expanded.
Well, I think Mr. Gorbachev, the last president and the first president of the Soviet Union, even in his memoirs, stated quite clearly that this is not how it was perceived. At least in Russia, many perceived that there was an explicit promise that NATO would not keep moving towards Russian borders. And maybe that has been a misunderstanding, but rather than arguing about that, I want to ask you whether you believe Germany has any special role in solving the issue in Ukraine and helping Russia, Ukraine, others to come to certain accommodation, or whether you believe this is just a European security issue that has to be handled by all.
Well, I don't think in this particular case, since one of the basic and dominating purposes of the European Union is to keep the peace. That's from where the Union idea started after the Second World War. And so if there is the relationship to Ukraine, if there are these differences, basic differences, having developed in the eastern part, it is a European issue. And Germany is acting within this European understanding. We have we don't see we have special responsibility. Here, the European responsibility is the governing idea.
Mr. Biddenkopf, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your being on the show today. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.